Madam Chairman, yeah, if we could go right to discussion before finance begins, the manager was going to discuss this.
Members of the board, this has been very clear to everyone. The past week, we've had major disruptions to our services beginning a week ago Wednesday. We're doing the storm, electrical wires and trees fell upon the tracks of the Orange Line. And concluding, it's my wish, yesterday with the bent rail on the Orange Line, and I've asked our staff to evaluate our response to each one of those, what happened, what occurred, what did we do, what could we have done better. And this morning, Gerald Francis, who's the Deputy General Manager and Chief Operating Officer, will make a report, and then we will answer any questions members of the board have concerning those events.
Thank you, Ms. Cato. I'll try not to make this too long. I wanted to tie this in with a communication initiative that was going to be at the committee in the next couple of weeks. I got a statement I would like to read. I'd like to make a statement on some of the recent events. First, we have had several unpredictable events occur, and we apologize for the inconvenience that caused our customers. Let me begin with this disruption last week between East Falls and West Falls Church Metro Rail Station. The weather that afternoon caused damage all across the region and brought power lines down over all the tracks. Unable to move these power lines, we were forced to suspend rail service between East and West Falls Church. While we were waiting for the track to be cleared, we began a bus bridge between the stations to try to move as many customers as possible. Bus bridges are problematic as they must move through the same traffic as the other vehicles that are on the street. Certainly, though, if there were bus-only lanes in place across the region, our buses could move far faster and move more people during these incidents. Still, given that limitation, we are committed to getting our customers where they need to go as quickly as possible. The next problem we face is the fact that our buses can hold 50 people, and a six-car train can hold from anywhere from 900 to 1,000 people. So it takes roughly about 18 to 20 buses to carry the same number of people you can fit on a train, and trains are coming every 6 minutes, or in some cases, sooner. That afternoon, we used 15 buses to transport people from East and West Falls Church Metro Rail Station, and they moved approximately 2,000 people. 15 buses that what was used as spares at that time. What we have out there doing both AM and PM rush periods is what we call strategic buses that we use in situations like this.
Mr. Francis, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but did you not also have services from a connector service that supplemented that?
Yes, it's my understanding that we did have a service that assisted in this. Do we need more strategic buses and operators? Unfortunately, it doesn't make financial sense to keep 100 buses and operators on emergency call and standby waiting to respond to disruptions like this. I can see from the comments we received from customers that there is still work to be done on communicating, and that will be the subject of the presentation. Also, there was a code red. I also know that the chairman has some questions about the delay on Monday in implementing the free rides when a code red was declared. In short, Metro was not informed of changes made by the Council of Governors, and the notification for that code red came from an organization that we did not recognize as having the authority. We have since clarified who that notification will come from, and this shouldn't happen again.
My understanding is that you were notified about 3:30 Sunday afternoon.
We received a fax in the Bus Operation Control Center Friday that gave us Saturday, Sunday, and detailed Monday. Saturday, it said it was code orange. Sunday was a code orange. And when the fax came through on Monday, you couldn't read in the box if it was, it said unspecified, and which turned out to be it was a code red. But I will say that when that came across, one of the things that we noted was if we didn't understand that at that particular time, we could have made a call. Our guys did make a call first thing in the morning.
Not quite first thing.
Well, it was, I think it was around 7 o'clock. Find out what had happened. And then we made the adjustments there.
Well, we're going to have to clarify, because I've been specifically told that you were notified at 3:30 p.m. on Sunday, June 2nd.
We were notified at some time on Sunday concerning the next day, and you're right. The facts that we received had a, was in red, that it would be a code red day. The fax itself, when it came out, was black, and you couldn't read it. It's still our responsibility, and I accept the responsibility of failure on this part, to have called to find out what was in that box. We failed to do that. And I can really give you no justification for why we failed to do it. And what we now have as part of our instructions, and we have people assigned to make those calls, any notifications coming in, we should call, follow up, to determine who the organization is, what the intent of the communications was, and to take action. I cannot give you an excuse for us just saying because the box was black, we didn't respond. The next step should have been the call, and we didn't do that.
Thank you. Question. Question on that. Is that the typical way that communications come through on a subject like this, through a fax? I mean, it seems in 2008 a rather outdated, insufficient way to communicate. And I'm just wondering, is that the only way that we get notification?
To my knowledge, what happens is we do get the communication the day before, and it comes in around anywhere between, you know, being around 1 to 2:30. We get the information, and we call the divisions and be ready for the next day. Now, I will say, and I haven't got all the facts, but there was a meeting yesterday between Metro staff and COG to go through some other avenues that we can make sure that we don't miss any type of communication that occurs.
It will be emails, fax, and as I said, in any communications in the future, it's our responsibility to initiate a callback and to ensure that we have all the information.
Okay, thank you.
Now let's move to the derailment that happened on Monday. An Orange Line train to Vienna was traveling between the Roslyn and Courthouse Metro Rail stations in manual mode, which is our standard operating procedure during that time of day. Just before 2:45 p.m., the front wheels of the third car shifted out between the tracks. The Metro employee riding on the train reported to the train operator that there were a problem with how the train was riding. A short time elapsed between the time the derailment occurred and the operator stopped the train at 2:45, but in that time, the train had traveled about 2,700 feet. The operator asked for and received clearance to leave the train, which is a procedure that ensures safety for our customers, for our operators. The operator then surveyed the entire train for damage and reported back to the Operation Control Center. This is an important part of the procedure that allows Metro to give the responding fire department a report of the actual situation. That way there won't be any situations that they go into blind. The Operation Control Center notified the fire department at about 3:02 p.m. Metro deployed a rescue train and had evacuated the train by 4:25 p.m. There were no injuries reported, and our train operator informed as to what the problem was. I commend that operator for doing his efforts. This had a large impact on the success of the rescue. The customers remained patient and calm, and if they had tried to self-evacuate, there had been situations that happened in other transit properties that would have put us into another emergency situation. Once the passengers had been rescued, we could document the accident and begin our investigation. That being complete, our track maintenance workers made repairs that allowed us to put the Orange Line back into service the next day. I want to commend them for that fine work. It took from 2:30, we had this system back up at 5 o'clock, and there was a lot of coordination because our concern then was to try to make sure that we wouldn't add further impact to our customers the following day. Last night, finally, there was a disruption, as Mr. Cato mentioned. Although our passengers were inconvenienced, our operators acted properly and stopped this train before going over a section, what we call kink track. Exhibited excellent judgment and may have prevented an accident. Additionally, we were able to continue rail operations by moving around that area. It is slower, but safety is the key here. We also set up some bus bridges as another option for customers traveling through that area and provide free trips on some of our regular routes. Now, this brings me to the presentation that I want to quickly go through. Over the past months, we have been developing new channels through which we can
drive.
It's your.
I would like to suggest staff's been working on this presentation, response to earlier things. It's, of course, not scheduled for today. I would suggest that it be carried over to the next meeting of the Operations Committee, focus on the issues that as it's discussing. I think is what we really have to talk about. This is focused on a specific aspect of communications, which is one part of what we need to talk about today. But that's communications with customers. We have communications issues that aren't only with customers. We have communications issues with jurisdictions, and it seems we have communications issues within Metro itself. And I'd like to talk about kind of a little more detail about some of the issues that came up through the three incidents now over the past week. And I think there's a few things that, in particular, need to get some focus on. One, the question about the timing of notification when the derailment occurred Monday. Now, there's been a lot of focus on when the fire department was called and how quickly that was. And I think what we had pointed out was it was very quickly after you knew it was a derailment. And they responded very quickly, and everything, thank goodness, went well then. Everybody got out safely. But there is a question about how long it took to notify up until the determination. I think there's a fundamental question about whether it's appropriate to wait until that point before notifying local, in this case Arlington, but local emergency services providers. And that's something I don't expect us to determine today, and I don't expect personally to determine. I'm a layperson. I don't necessarily know what the best thing to do is. But I do know that the people who do this in my jurisdiction say they want to know right away. And, you know, the thought of having 1,000 people sitting on a train that stopped in a tunnel for an indefinite amount of time, because you have to determine now how serious is the situation, and not have the emergency service providers know that they may be suddenly having to do something, I think that's time lost. Again, you know, I'm not the expert, but this is what I hear from our police chief, our fire chief. And I have suggested to Mr. Cato when we talked on Monday that this would be a good opportunity to get together with those from around the region and discuss what protocol should be. This isn't the only issue that would be involved, but I think this is a big question. You know, when do you really want us to call you when we think we might have an issue? And, you know, I understand that there will be a whole lot of situations in which maybe it's going to be a never mind. And so protocols do have to be worked out. But I just think that it's a risk. I mean, I'm glad nothing bad was happening on the train, you know, on a hot day when people are trapped in there for some period of time. But if you lose 15 minutes, that might really matter in the future. And clearly our folks think they'd like to know sooner. So that's one aspect of it, and I'll let you respond.
Well, you did. We did have this discussion, and I have asked and had discussions with our chief safety officer, and we will set up a meeting with the local fire departments. It's adjacent to all of our services, and have this discussion. It is the discussion of what comes first. Do we notify them, have them out there in every event, or do we make an assessment as quick as possible and then contact them? That is a discussion we're all going to have with the fire chiefs.
And I think developing a consensus on that is really important. I mean, I can imagine you could have different views on what you should be doing in different jurisdictions, so it's good to have a collective conversation on that. I think you really need to find a consensus.
Mr. Zimmerman, if I can add too, we went through every situation we have a debrief after it. I went through the standard operating procedures here at Metro, as well as what we should do in these situations. And we are going to set a meeting up. It's in the process now with the chiefs in the three jurisdictions to make sure that we all understand what those procedures are. One of the things that we want to make sure is that the procedure does reflect, in fact, what each agency is supposed to do. In this particular situation, the standard operating procedure called for us to go out and ensure with the operator to go ensure that what type of damage they had, then call the control center to make the call. I don't know if we, as you mentioned before, is that too much time? Should we make the call sooner or not? So the meeting will be set up as soon as possible, hopefully early next week, so we can talk to the chiefs and find out.
That's good, because what wound up happening was that the notification to activate the Emergency Operations Center in Arlington didn't come until 3:15, half an hour after the incident. Now, had there been a more serious situation than we wound up having, we would not have wanted to lose that time. But there's other aspects of communication. That's the emergency part. That's when does, you know, the fire department know, for instance. But there's also communication with jurisdictional agents that is also relevant to respond, in particular the transit staff and transportation staff in the jurisdiction. He didn't seem to have really good communication there either, which hampered the ability to respond in a number of ways. For instance, we have at the Roslyn Station, we have a person who's dedicated to supervising operations there. Obviously, that's created a real problem when you're hung up between Roslyn and Courthouse. Our staff, who do transportation services in Arlington, had to physically send somebody to run down the street to find the person because they couldn't find a way to communicate with them directly. And obviously, that delayed things that we might have done to help respond to a situation in which now you're obviously losing significant capacity at a key location. We also provided routes to use for the bus bridges that were intended to be ideal to shorten the amount of time that you would take in moving people around. They weren't followed. And again, I think with better communication, your bus bridge would function more efficiently. We don't seem to have that jurisdiction to agency communication. A similar situation occurred last week, weather situation, the problems at East Falls Church. Now, one thing that I don't know if you're aware of, Mr. Cato, because it goes back 2 years, but it's more than 2 years ago now, Northern Virginia Transportation Commission with a federal grant, I think it was one of those Homeland Security things, whatever, but a number of exercises were run and planning was done by WMATA and NBTC that developed plans for incidents that might occur at any of the major stations in Virginia. That, as I understand, includes situations not unlike what we had last Wednesday. However, those incident plans were not followed. So that specifically, I mean, to give you an example of the kind of thing that was in there and analyzed then and that wasn't followed, one of the questions was if you have a problem with one of the outer stations, where do you launch the bridges, the bus bridges from? And the conclusion was you want to stage out of Ballston because it's better equipped to handle that. You don't want to stage out of, say, East Falls Church. And from what a lot of people have told me, it sure sounds like they were right and that staging out of East Falls Church don't work too good. So, you know, that's the kind of thing where I don't know if those plans suddenly got lost, if, again, it's an internal communication issue, but it seems like the kind of responses that we have to make in these situations could be done a lot better. Again, things can't help the fact there's going to be storms that bring down power and shut down train lines. We don't know the cause yet of what happened on Monday, and you know, certainly withhold any judgment on that until we see. Those things are going to happen, and I think people understand that. But how we respond to them is something they will always hold us responsible for. And while I do want to, you know, talk more ultimately about communication with customers, which I think we all agree needs to get better, this is sort of basic coordination among the people who can help you do your job in these situations. And I'm not sure that we're at this point reaching the standard that the public expects, that the board would expect, or I think, Mr. Cato, that you would.
I just wanted to, this is not a committee report for planning and development, so Mr. Zimmer, if you want, you can direct what goes on here. But I don't know about the item here, but I do think that we should not wait to talk about some of the customer pieces, because having experienced the bus bridging when an occurrence occurs at a station, the lack of communication between the mezzanine area and the platform has been demonstrated to be extremely critical, because if I take the West Falls Church Station, for example, if you are coming into the West Falls Church Station and an incident has occurred, there is not the immediate communication before you get down to the platform. And it was consistent again from one incident about 5 months ago that happened again last Monday, that unfortunately the people missed the communication. And the question I asked is about the safety. We would want those folks to know not to go down and stand on the platform where there will not be a train. But there's only one person that is there communicating with people, and it is the station manager. In both incidents, the station manager either was unaware at the time or was too consumed with too many other things. And we've talked about the role of the station manager. And to me, we need to look clearly on the communication side of what we intend the role of our station manager to be. And in the case of an emergency, think about what that role is and the inability to function efficiently. It's not that they're not doing the job the best they can do, but they have an overwhelming job now. They have people who are coming in normal situations. You're directing them in abnormal situations. And it's one person that is the orchestra of that. And I think we really must think about the station manager in general and the station manager's role in an emergency when they follow their general procedure of it's my station and I must do all the communication. Monday was frightening for a lot of people. And I think, as Mr. Gentleman alludes, they could have been more, the customers could have been more helpful, but the absence of communication. And in both incidents, I learned that the platforms were loaded because they hadn't gotten the piece of communication and that the Fairfax was still bringing people in and they were not knowing to go across the station to get the bus. They were used to standing in the station, going down, or going in the opposite direction. So I give that example because I think there's another part to this just communicating. It's determining whether the current functionality of the station manager and the setup at our stations will work efficiently in an emergency if you are exercising a plan for communication.
Ms. Hudgens, in your package, you'll see on page 11 exactly what you're talking about, because one of our concerns is that obviously if we have a problem there, we don't want to let any of our customers come into the station. So we're looking at ways, that's just a quick signage that you'll see on that page, to let our customers know that we have a emergency situation and we'll do something different. But we're going through trying to see what works. And the other thing that you mentioned too is you're right, we have one station manager there. And other Metro employees who are in the area, we're making the call to all of them to come into the station to add assistance to that one station manager. And we'll be able to be outside as well if it's supervisors or whomever to not allow passengers to come down and get the information to them when we're in fact setting up bus bridges so we can make sure that we're getting the right information out to our customers.
I'd like to ask a question.
Yes.
Mr. Francis, this is something you talked about earlier, and it has to do with our customers' expectations for the service that we're going to provide. And you said something very quickly. I want to go back to it. Part of those expectations are that we will help them complete their trip as quickly as possible. And quickly doesn't mean 3 hours from now. And I'd like to explore very briefly what our capability is to actually meet that expectation. Now, what we typically do is build bus bridges when there's a rail failure. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you said something about there are strategic buses that we use in order to do that?
Yes, there's strategic buses out during the peak periods.
And during the peak periods, how many strategic buses do we have?
Probably about anywhere from 24 to 26.
So we got somewhere around 20-some-odd buses. And they are where?
Stationed between Virginia, the district, and Maryland.
So they're scattered around.
They're scattered around.
So if we have a rail failure and a station, you know, everything's closed beyond a certain station, we're bringing 20-some-odd buses from all over the region to that one station. Is that right?
We're trying to bring as many buses as we can. They can be the strategic buses. We'll look at the divisions to see what's available. Of course, you have to have the operators available as well.
So how many operators and buses could you conceivably have go to one of those locations?
Well, in the, give you an example.
Peak period failure, right.
Well, the other day we had 15 buses that we can get a hold of that carried about 2,000 passengers. I think during the Monday derailment, we had about 20 plus.
Okay, so we're still talking in the range 20, 30.
About 20, 25.
25 is probably the max that you would get.
Okay, the maximum number of buses. And in rush hour traffic, how quickly are they going to get to a station?
Realistically, you're looking at, and one of the things, if I could add, in that presentation, it says that we have, or maybe Metro's painted the picture of unrealistic expectations. Because the bottom line is, and we finally got to this point in the situation yesterday, when we call a bus bridge, and I think this is important for our customers, it's going to take us anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes to get there. And that's rounding the buses up, getting the operators in, giving them the information. What I want to do is, that's the information that should get out, go out to our customers. We had a good conversations a couple of times with Nancy Iacomini with RAC, who gave us some feedback on what our customers' expectations are, and as well as talking to our customers. And giving them that information gives them options. Some of them said, you know, I might be able to call somebody to pick me up or call a cab or whatever, but give me the option and let me know. So that's the realistic expectations that I see, that we will say that a bus bridge is requested, but expect one in 30 to 45 minutes. Then the other piece to it is, when the bus arrives, keeping in mind that a six-car train holds about 900 to 1,000 people, when a bus arrives, we can only take probably 50 people, 50 at a time. Like yesterday's event, we had the buses in the loop. I think the e-alert went out that it was about 15 or 20 buses. It said to expect them, and we were running a headway about, I think it was 20, 25 minutes. So at least that lets the customers know what we can do.
Let me go back, because you said some very important things there, and see if we can restate those slightly differently. You said there would be like 20, maybe 25 buses that would go to a location.
That's correct.
And you said that each one can take about 50 people.
About 50 people.
And a train has somewhere around 900 to 1,000. So once the buses get there, they can empty one train.
If you have the 20 buses.
If you had. So
if you had 20 buses.
If you finally get those buses there, and they've got to go through the same traffic that everybody else
does,
right. And if there's an emergency,
right.
There's probably going to be traffic problems there. They can then move one train load of people to wherever we're trying to take them.
That's correct. And keeping in mind how fast the buses get there.
Okay.
They can get there 10 minutes, 15 minutes apart.
So we're at best going to move one train load of people. How many train loads are going to have built up by the time you have 30 minutes just getting the buses there?
So depending, and unfortunately, it seems like when we have these incidents, they always happen during the peak rush hour, and we have 131 trains out there. And depending on where it's at, we can have anywhere from 6-minute headways to 2-minute, 2 to 2.5-minute headways. The situation yesterday with the Sun King on the Orange Line, we had anywhere from 2 to 3 trains backed up in either direction. So if you do the math, that's like 1,800 almost in both directions.
Okay, so what we're saying is, if it takes a half hour and you got roughly 5-minute headways, you're going to, at least in one direction, have 6 train loads of people absolutely packed coming there, and you can only take the first one with all the buses we have available to do it.
That's right.
So the expectation for the other 5 trains is?
It's going to take a great long period of time if we're just moving everyone by bus. If we're single tracking, then there is some relief there. But the period of time is indicated by the event last week, 3 to 4 hours, where everyone got home. To some people, it was quicker, but to a large number of people, a great deal of time was spent using an alternative mode of transportation.
I think it's important for our passengers to understand that we don't have the capability of moving them right away. That getting out of that station, getting onto a bus, and getting to some other station may take a number of hours, not a few minutes. And the expectation right now is very different. We have ourselves created an expectation that, you know, if something breaks down, don't worry, you just go right out of the station, there'll be a bunch of buses and they'll take you where you want to go. And there may be a slight delay, but we're really talking hours when we are in a peak period and there's a major breakdown and we can't be providing rail service. And I think that has got to be part of this process so that people can start to look at their own alternatives. Say, am I going to wait for Metro to provide this bridge? Am I going to try and find some other way to do it? Because there's a limit to what we can do, unless we want to make major investments in having buses sitting all over the region all the time with operators just waiting to go.
That's why we do everything we can to try to get into a single track mode, because we keep our customers on the train. Now, we may delay our customers 5, 10, 15 minutes, but they're on the train, and if we get through the single track, at least they can get to their destinations.
I need to communicate about that.
I want to follow up on that because, and I do think at some point we should be considering whether large investment in strategic buses might in fact make sense. I think it's a further argument for having bus lanes in our region, because if you had that, you could actually get places much faster and respond more quickly to these situations. But short of that, I think that emphasizes the need for communicating broadly and having alternatives available early on. Because, for instance, if you have this situation, there's, you know, Mr. Benjamin asked about what about the next train and the next train. You want to slow down that pipeline, which means you want people as far back as possible to quickly be assessing new alternatives. Because actually, we have capacity on other buses that are going places that are already on their regular routes. So somebody decides, you know, to get on a 38B instead of getting on the orange line, even though it almost always pays them to get on the orange line today, they learn in time. They don't go into this system. They get on a bus that's running anyway. And you know, that's the kind of thing where at least we can make the whole system work better if we can communicate to customers more effectively that they really do want to find an alternative and that there are some available that might work for people in different circumstances.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, the important part is we've got to tell them realistically what they can expect. And every situation is going to be different. We understand that. If you have both tracks blocked, you know, it's going to be very different from whether you can single track. But even in the best of all circumstances, and even if you're single tracking, you're going to have a lot of buildup that's going to occur. And what we really need to do is tell people, and as Mr. Zimmerman says, tell them as early as possible and as far away as possible, not just at the station where the incident is, but throughout the whole system. We need to be telling them what the issue is and what they need to expect. And just saying, well, there may be lengthy delays. You can say, look, it may be 2 hours or 3 hours. Find another way to get there. That's important to tell people, because just like when a highway gets blocked, you know, when a highway is blocked, nobody expects to be able to somehow or other get there. And they look for other ways to go. And we're the same as that. I'm sorry.
Just another, I guess, idea to consider. It sounds like we've talked a little bit about potential partnerships with the jurisdictions themselves to kind of better coordinate our response. I'd encourage the authority to think about other partnerships, perhaps with the taxi industry, and maybe an opportunity to actually get them to respond with you as part of this incident. And just kind of think creatively about who else the partnerships could be with.
You know, I was going to say to all the committee members, Mr. Zimmerman suggested that I do the presentation, but it seems like you guys have already, you're doing it for me. Most of the things that you mentioned here, and I'm going to add some too, are in here. One of the things we talked about yesterday is doing, I call them table topics or desk topics, and we have scenarios we talked about doing one a month, and what Mr. Zimmerman said is one of the things we didn't look at is utilizing other alternatives in the different jurisdictions. And bring them to the table and sit down and put a scenario out there and say, here it is, at whatever station, what can we do, who can we call on, and so forth.
I just wanted to say that it was a very aggravating experience for our customers. But I think we should add to this note that it became more aggravating because our transportation networks in general are so overstressed, so that when we think about an emergency during peak, and we recognize or we emphasize just how much dependence the metro means to the community, because the understanding I had was that even though when buses and others got onto the roads, there was no room to move on those roads. So I think that the customers understand their alternative that they've made. It's the dependency and the communication that we really want to continue to provide them.
Supervisor Hudgens, there for you, you for the folks meeting in the General Assembly.
Well, that is the message for folks meeting in the General Assembly, and the message of the extensions that are needed throughout this region to continue the transportation, the transit network that's needed, because that is where our customers are gravitating to every day, and when they are not there, the roads will not accommodate them.
Yeah, I just want to go back to page 11 real quick, because we talked about the signs, and I think the most aggravating thing about this was for the folks who were arriving at the station not knowing something was going on and going down, and they could have been prevented from even going in the station. And I understand why we have to make these generic, to put them out to raise awareness, but a couple months ago we had a presentation on the new flat screen devices with the advertising on them that would have the people that would tell you about disruptions, and I seem to remember a conversation about the placement at those stations and how they would be seen. And I just want us to be aware that this is a great example here of why they have to be placed in a place where people can see them before they enter the station, or at least before they go through the turnstile, because that would be the type of device that would give the information to them in more detail than just the delay. If I'm going into a station, if I'm not at the end of the line, you don't know what direction I'm going to be heading in. And it very well could be the direction I'm heading in is not experiencing the delay. I would only get that level of information from one of those electronic devices, not from one of these signs. So when that item comes back to us, I guess, for final approval, I would hope that we give a lot more consideration to the placement of those on a station-by-station basis to prevent people from going into a problem.
We will move over to the next.
The communication initiatives, the station manager interaction. First of all, this your report, staff report came to the board October 07 with regards to some recommendations. But yet, in the station manager interaction, training of station managers didn't commence until June 4th of this year. Why was there such a delay moving forward on that? So we have seen, I mean, irrespective of the recent incidents, but the most important thing, that which again speaks to what didn't happen, why didn't happen, the lack of communication, one would think that that would have been something that could have happened a month ago.
I think you have to blame me on that. The station managers do go through their training. That has never stopped. But I went in back in and rewrote, with some assistance of the operating personnel, some emergency procedures that I want to see in there, and what you're saying there in June 4th was what I added in there. But they, station managers, go through the training program, recertification program. One of the things that we found out was that they weren't flexible. That's why in that package you see there, in some of the stations we have handheld mics and we have the radios as well.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. I think it's Mr. Benjamin.
Do you want to have a short break, or do you want to go into the next one?
I have a break.
I didn't hear that, Mr. Keep rolling. Okay. So the I'm calling to order the meeting of the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee. And given the lateness of the hour, we will try to move through this as quickly as we possibly can. We do have a lot of items on our agenda. Looking at that agenda, are there any additions, corrections, or changes to the agenda? If not, regard the agenda as approved. I have substantial changes to the minutes. I don't think the minutes were put together quite the way that they should have been, so I'm suggesting that we send them back and not consider them at the present time. Are there any objections to deferring the minutes? If not, moving to the action items, Ms. Wilson has a proposal to reserve funding for marketing initiatives. This is essentially a carryover funding from this year to next year. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Benjamin. And I'm also joined by Ron Riestrom, who's our director of marketing here. My request is to carry over $1 million from FY08 funds into FY09. And for the purposes of better communications, better customer service, improved safety, environmental stewardship, and employee recognition. We had a year this past year in which we did not spend significant funds from our FY08 budget, but that we do expect to expend in FY09. Some examples include several hundred thousand dollars in a customer environment study that we did not conduct this year. And we intend to apply that money toward the Mystery Rider program, which the board has already approved. We also had a public perceptions of tracking study for $100,000 that we did not do. But given the situation with gas prices and the renewed focus on energy and the environment, that is something that we will be undertaking this coming year. So that's money that was not spent this year, but that will be spent next year. In addition, we had some cost savings. And so not all the money that I've saved this year will be, I'm not asking for all the money that I've saved this year to be applied for next year. Some examples of some money that we saved this year include several hundred thousand dollars on our brochures and inventory and printing, by having better inventory management of our brochures, our bus schedules. We were able to reduce the amount of money that was spent on printing, inside printing, and we also we recognized almost $200,000 in that savings, and that money has been eliminated, reduced from the budget for my FY09 budget. Some of the benefits that would be realized by this carryover include better customer service. We're looking to foster better relationships with our community of customers and strengthen our internal customer service messaging so that our employees are aligned with our customers for improved customer service. On the safety side, we're looking to inform customers about ways that they can improve their own safety, to take a look at some of the behaviors that we observe that contribute to some of the safety problems that we have, and to look for efforts to curb those kinds of behaviors. On the environment issue, obviously, it's been a huge issue for us. We haven't really capitalized on it very much here. And we have an interesting opportunity to draw people to transit, particularly to our bus service, who may not traditionally look to transit for, as a way to resolve the environment issue. And last, employee recognition. I may have misspoken when I say employee recognition. What we're really talking about is a way to introduce our employees to the public, and a way to humanize Metro. In addition, for next year, just to be mindful, I've got a lot of things going on. We've got a lot of things going on in the area next year that we'll be focusing on the marketing efforts, including the inauguration once every 4 years. It's going to be, given all the attention with the election this year, we anticipate whoever wins that we will have a pretty significant inaugural event. It also comes at the tail end of a four-day weekend. We anticipate lots of activity during those 4 days, and a huge opportunity for people to get to know Metro. We'll have we have another opportunity with our new buses coming in. They have a whole new look, and probably the first time I'd be able to say that a beautiful buses that are going to be coming in, and for a whole new experience for people who may not look at buses as an attractive option. The new look, the new feel of our buses, we're looking to capitalize on that in marketing efforts. We also have the elimination of paper transfers coming up in January, and that's going to be a huge effort to educate our existing customers and new customers on that. And that will be done both in English and in Spanish, and we'll look at other languages as we need to. And these are some of the things that we're going to be looking at in 09, and for reasons that looking for a pretty robust marketing budget. Finally, with the arrival of our general manager a year and a half ago, and in the ensuing 18 months, we've really made a huge change from being a construction organization to being an operations and customer service focused organization. And while we've been working sort of behind the scenes to manifest that, we have not yet had kind of a public description of what it is that we're doing. And this would be an opportunity for us to undertake that in fiscal year 09. Okay. That's it.
Make one comment and then ask some questions. I just wanted to note that in the past, there used to be lots of requests like this for carryover of funds. It happened on a fairly regular basis, and finally the board got pretty frustrated about it and established a policy under which funds could or could not be carried over, which happens automatically. This is essentially asking the board to ignore that policy and make a big exception. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Well, that's where I was going, Mr. Chairman. I'm really perplexed by this, particularly because of the timing. I mean, the next item on this budget, on this agenda, is the approval of the 09 budget. And I really don't understand why in June I have a request for carrying over funds from the 08 budget to the 09 budget when, you know, outside the budget process, when I'm just at the conclusion of the budget process. I mean, the general manager wants to recommend that we spend $1 million this way of carryover funds. You think that's part of his budget recommendation, or even at least a supplementary recommendation? And to, you know, to take one department and say, well, they have some extra money that's throughout the agency, and don't get very intelligent budgeting that way. That's why we don't do it. I don't know that this $1 million is best spent in the way that we just heard described, which might be all great stuff. I don't know that's better than spending $1 million somewhere else in the agency. I'll limit it. How about we just talk about communications? We just had a discussion about communications needs. Things like the fact that there aren't screens in the station when you walk in, as Mr. McKay was just talking about, to tell you, despite the fact that everywhere you go in the world now, there's a flat screen every time you turn around telling you something. we can't seem to get these things in Metro. Now, you know, I don't know that I wouldn't rather spend $1 million on that than on this particular set of things for marketing. But, you know, that's, these aren't choices. I don't understand why this is before us in this manner. And the fact that some of the things were cited, you know, particularly I heard the end of paper transfers, that's something that, you know, is policy direction from last year. And I have to assume that given the extensive discussion that was made in making the approval and the way we approve what we approve, that the staff is prepared to do that with the funds we've budgeted. So I don't get this.
Let me, Mr. Zimmerman,
sure.
Let me go back, and perhaps I should have clarified my comments before talking about the efforts that we're going to be undertaking in 09. You're right. Those efforts have been budgeted for in 09. Some of them have been. But I was kind of saying that as a way of kind of preempting any anticipating any questions about why we couldn't use that existing money, or why it was that I wasn't going to be able to use the existing money. So, to be fair, you're right. I just want to make sure that everybody is aware that there's going to be a lot of opportunities for us in 09 in a whole bunch of different arenas. And some of them are budgeted, and those are sort of that laundry list that I went through. Some of them are not budgeted.
Any other comments, questions? What is the budget for this area for 08?
We have a $5.2 million budget for our advertising and marketing budget.
And what is it for just advertising and TNT functions, which are the ones that, I guess, or advertising functions, which are the ones you're talking about here?
For advertising, it's $1.76 million, and for services, it's $1.4
million. So, okay. And what's the increase that you would otherwise get next year?
Actually get a 0.2% increase.
Okay, so you're saying the 8.2% increase isn't enough and you want...
No, 0.2.
0.2.
0.2, yes.
That's not what I see in this book. Why is that? This book shows advertising going up from 1.8 million to over 2 million, which is about a 10% increase.
My overall marketing budget is for non-personnel is 0.2%.
Yeah, but when I look at the things you're talking about here, what I see is advertising going up 10% and P&T going up 7%. And everything you described falls in those two categories, and presumably that's what you want to carry over. You're actually asking for an additional almost 50% increase in your budget. That's pretty whopping.
It's relatively small compared to the advertising budgets of other major transit properties.
I understand. But if we're going to do that, I'm back to where Mr. Zimmerman is, which is then we ought to be proposing a much larger budget as part of the budget process, not saying let's do it by doing a carryover, which then affects, first of all, a major policy that the board did put together, and second of all, the results of this year's subsidy. And what you would be doing is reducing the amount of auto adjustment for this year, and you would be reducing the amount that could go into the reserve for this year, as opposed to dealing with next year's budget. Mr. Cato.
The process obviously is not one that the board is very happy with, but from the perspective of the campaign that Ms. Wilson mentioned, it is when it is critical to the organization. There's a different way, means different approaches of doing this. This was an attempt to carry over funds that aren't being utilized this year. The other approach we could take is to adjust the marketing budget and the overall budget, but not raise the overall budget.
Right.
And accomplish what we want to accomplish.
I think that's what Mr. Zimmerman was saying. Are there other comments? Is there a motion to approve this request? Not hear a motion to approve this request. I take it that therefore the committee is not interested in sending this on to the board?
At this time.
Not at this time.
I sense that.
I think we need to move to the next item, which is the FY09 budget.
I hope that the first Step is not an indication of what's happening. Second step is, well, we put our information together. Before starting to get into the details of the presentation, I want to highlight some of the issues in the budget that we're going to present to you. And one of the things I just want to mention, this budget does show an increase in passenger revenues. However, given what's been happening at the last month, and we will bring back additional information to you, it might even be greater than what we anticipated. Yesterday, our ridership was 805,000 people, which is starting to happen quite often now. And there was no ball game yesterday, so it was not a result of taking people to the ball game. We need to understand what those numbers are and what the implications are with the increased ridership, because I suspect it's going to increase even greater than those numbers. Having said that, a great deal of work on the part of the board, you too, Mr. Chairman, especially you, have occurred over the past few months in developing and presenting a balanced budget. The budget will keep the contributions that we're asking for from the jurisdictions below the March 2008 cap directed by the board. This was a directive that was made very clear in the last meeting that we had discussing the overall budget. We've been able to balance this budget and still fund some needed improvements. We will be able to increase the Metro Transit Police Department, if approved, by 25 officers and 3 sergeants. This is a necessary addition. These officers will primarily perform undercover operations and work the more than 200 special events held in the region on an annual basis. And that includes the National Games, the DC and Marine Corps marathons, the number of rallies and protests that are held downtown, and also provide support for events, emergency events such as the ones that have occurred over the past week. This will alleviate the need to move officers from the regular patrols, and again, we will provide the highest level of security necessary in the system. In addition, there is a request to improve the number of supervisors who will be out on the street monitoring our services and helping our services to perform at a higher level, a higher quality level, particularly on the bus side. In addition, there is a few positions for the radio control center, including individuals who will handle the communications with our customers when there are disruptions of services. We will be able, if this budget is approved, to restructure and improve our 30 lines, which will allow us to improve services for over 20,000 riders a day. In addition, this is another step towards implementing better services on the 24 priority bus corridors. During the off-peak periods, we will continue to offer Yellow Line service to Fort Barton and continue to run our Red Line trains to Shady Grove instead of turning each other train back at Grosvenor. On the bus side, the budget will fund Metro Extra and the College Park Bethesda J4 bus is a regional service. In addition, funding this budget will reallocate existing funds to critical infrastructure needs through FY10. As we mentioned in past presentations, due to cash flow, we've been able to locate dollars to fix some of the critical capital projects listed in our urgent unfunded capital needs. There are many things that we looked at. We've made reductions throughout the agency to ensure that we balance this budget. It is balanced, does meet the directions given to us. To go into the details, I'm asking our Chief Financial Officer, Chuck Woodruff, to take you through all of the details of the 2009 budget.
Before you start, yes. I do want to compliment you on exactly what you just said, which is, we finally got around to telling you what the box looked like that you had to be inside of. You did an excellent job of building a budget that fits within that box and meets what we stated we needed. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
I think the general manager has given you quite a bit of the detail of
of what is in the budget, I'd like to call your attention to page 20, and I can show you from a numbers standpoint what adjustments were made to make this all feasible. And you can see on this chart what Mr. Cato has talked about, that there are two bus lines and two rail operations that are regionally funded, the departmental cuts we've talked about. We've talked about the increase in the revenue from fiber optics, not fund the retiree trust set aside. The new one is that we are proposing that we reduce by $6 million the claims reserve for worker comp third-party liability. That's a reserve. There still would be a reserve of approximately $5 million based on current projections. So this is a reasonable thing to do. We've also going down to eliminate charter bus based on FTA regs. It would appear that Metro will no longer be in the charter bus business, which has revenue and expenditures associated with it, the net of that being $500,000. Two other things not shown on this chart, but that I want to point out, because in past charts you've seen this, we were proposing to lease purchase phones, handsets, for $3.6 million. We're proposing that that be deferred until a future time. We had also proposed carrying forward $3 million from 08 to 09, projected ending balance for 08, and we have eliminated that. So those are the changes that have been made. And as Mr. Cato pointed out, the net of all these would be a reduction in subsidy of $2.2 million. And you see on page 21 how that would apply to the jurisdictions.
Mr. Woodruff, can I stop you for a minute? Because this is a very important table. Let me first just check to see if anybody else has any questions about it.
Well, is there a chart or something that refers to, like, the budget for new reductions?
Sorry, which ones?
This budget for new claims, $6 million. Is there a chart or something like that?
Yes, sir. It is on page 35. And the chart to the right, cash on hand, you can see the history of this going from significant cash on hand 5 years ago, dipping down to 07, where we actually were out of cash. And then in 08, it built somewhat. And then the chart we're looking at reflects the reduction of $6 million. So we would still carry forward a reserve or cash on hand of approximately $5 million in 09, and then that would be somewhat replenished in 10 and beyond.
This assumes an expenditure of $42 million in 09?
Yes, I believe that's the budget number. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr.
Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Monomy.
Two quick questions. The increase in energy budget, is that based upon the anticipated savings due to the swap that's potentially proposed swaps, or is this based upon current costs?
The increase in the energy budget for 09.
For 09.
Yeah, there's two things driving the budget in 09, and those were brought to the board, I believe, at our last meeting. One is electricity rates are going to go up significantly, I believe about 30%, and diesel fuel has gone up. We have a budget now of about $39 million for about 13 million gallons of diesel fuel. We did do the swap this year, and we project that from market rates, that's going to save us about $5 million. There's an entire presentation, but to give you the highlights, the swap was very favorable in this volatile market for fuel, so that was very positive. So the increases are for electricity and for diesel fuel, and I would say the area of concern in this budget, Mr. Cato pointed out, there could be good news on the revenue side as we see the ridership increase nearly daily. The concern may be on the diesel side. We've pushed it up to $3.25 a gallon. We're paying $4 a gallon today. There are some forecasters who predict that will come down somewhat in 09. That's a hard one to call for the coming year. And we are asking in here that you give us permission to swap
in '09. Our current swap authorization ends June 30th.
Okay, and then there'll be some, I guess I'll have some comments about the thresholds for initiating the swap once we get to that conversation. But the bus revenue forecast, based upon, this is an uptick or a downtick?
Downtick.
Coming down.
Coming down by 2.2. That seems, yes. Doesn't seem intuitive to me.
Well, the financials, which we'll also look at later in this presentation, I believe bus revenue is $1.8 million below budgeted projection this year. And so we're reflecting that base reduction into 08. That could change, but it is supported by data through April.
What's happened is we've not lost riders on the bus side. Is that our projections in the past were, the numbers were too high. And so we're making that adjustment.
And it's the 08 projection that was
yes.
too high. And so you're saying the base
right.
has got to come down just to get us to the right
budget. It's not reduced.
It's not a reduced ridership.
Right. It's reduced estimates as opposed to reduced ridership.
But not as much as we thought it was.
Right. Exactly. Well, I guess I'm just, I know we need to be conservative in budgeting. We're based upon, $4 gas, a gallon gas, and rising up to at least 4.5, they're saying. And my expectation is when I see more people jumping to the bus or to the road.
And you're right about that. I would rather come back to this board and tell you we have more revenues than we anticipated versus selling you a budget than we find out we don't have the revenues.
Understood. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? I have two. One is there's the biggest single number, no, not the biggest single, the second biggest single number is the departmental budget cuts. And I don't really have any idea what they are. I understand everybody cut their budget, which is very good, but what did we end up not doing?
Well, actually, there were cuts and requests for increases. We came up with a number. We knew that we needed to balance the budget, and I instructed each department head to go through their proposed budgets and cut that amount out. It was, in most cases, it did not impact any existing programs. In some cases, we looked at a history of underspending and decided that we're going to take that out. In other cases, which I think was the vast majority of it, it was proposed additional efforts that did not really, in my judgment, meet the critical needs of the organization for this year. No program that you'll are aware of has been cut. There's no major program that's been cut out, with the exception, of course, of the leasing of the telephones that we identified as a separate issue.
So in this 12.6, it's small enough numbers in each department that there are no things that we would look at and say, oh, you're going to have less of this or less of that, or less of an increase in this or that?
I do not believe so. It's, you can go into the detail on it.
Yeah, and I think the answer, Mr. Benjamin, is no, you won't see that. You're going to see in the financials today that we're projecting a surplus of $12 million at the end of this fiscal year, fiscal 08. You'll see that the vast majority of that, $10 million, is in under expenditures in the budget. Now, some of those are in salary accounts, but in looking at services, for example, we looked at trends, as Mr. Cato said, realized that we had some surplus there in past years and current year, and reduce some of those accounts. So the answer to your question is I don't think you're going to see anything that's not going to happen because we made a large reduction in any one area.
I guess in the future it would be useful for us to know what the categories of those were, not, this department went down $2 here and that department went down $4 there, but grand total, where did this $12.6 million come out? And it sounds like a lot of it might have come out of areas like services, which we've been talking to you about anyway.
Yes, it did.
The other one, and I want to mention, you have something.
I just have a question about this chart, but I can
go ahead.
But I just want a better explanation of what the do not fund retiree health trust means, that 4.7 figure up there.
That is GASB 34. It's a requirement that we either must fund liability for retiree health payments or show it on the balance sheet, one or the other. And many meetings ago, there was great discussion at the board level about this, and the indication that we got was that at this time, given the priorities, given the limitation on funding, that we would simply record this on the financial statement, we would not set money aside at this time to fund it. The board can choose to do that at any point in the future, but as this budget is now structured, you would not do that in fiscal 09.
That was very well worded. Thank you.
I wanted to make sure it was the same thing. I remember that conversation.
Yes, sir.
There's also an item that shows up many times, and I want to make this comment once, and it's one that Mr. Mona may want to focus on. Because it does keep showing up, and it has to do with the offset for the Southeast Garage deadhead cost. Now, if I understand from a policy point of view what this board did, I believe it said when we sell the garage, money will go to a reserve, and that reserve will in fact pay for those overhead costs, for those deadhead costs. And if we get to the point that the deadhead costs exceed the amount in the reserve, then the District of Columbia will cover those costs. Do I understand that correctly?
Carol, Ms. Kate will address that.
No, it's not actually.
Okay.
The board could do that.
Okay, but we didn't do that.
We didn't do that.
Okay, please explain what we did.
Chambliss handing out the actual resolution. And the operative language is on page 2. I'll wait for a second. So the Board of Directors, as you know, authorized the utilization of almost $1.4 million been previously authorized for capital purposes. Board transferred those to the operating reserve for the increased operating costs. Next to the last resolve provides that once these funds are expended, the District of Columbia will fund these additional operating expenses until the Southeastern Bus Garage is sold and a replacement Metro Bus Garage is acquired. That language, as I understand, is based upon what staff's projections are for and the timeline for replacing the garage.
Just to clarify again, this when the thought was that originally we thought that we were going to be able to sell the garage, Southeast Bus Garage, and acquire a new site at the same time, and that the $9.25 million would be ample funds to carry us through until the completion of the construction project. Now, if we were to sell the bus garage today, but not have a site to begin the construction of a new site, we need funding to get us to the time when we can start the construction of the new site, when the 9.25 would then be available to pay the expenses over that about 2-year period.
If I may try to interpret what you said, there was the $9 million that we first set aside. Is that right?
Well, we haven't.
Once the money became available.
Yes, 9.25.
We said
yes.
This would be set aside once the money is available.
Correct.
Okay. And then did this last set of words, the last but one resolve, override that and say, no, the only money that's available is $1.4 million?
The $1.4 was an added funding from the capital, as Ms. O'Keefe mentioned, that was left over from the design of the new facility.
But the previous board action, the one before this, I thought set aside money to do this, assuming that the bus garage would be sold. Is that
and
right?
Yes.
Okay. So from a budgetary point of view, if that money were there, that's what the source would be for paying for the deadhead cost.
Which money?
The
9.25?
Yeah.
If there was a new site for us to build a bus garage on.
Okay, so if there were a new site, and if we had sold the old site,
correct,
then there would be 9.25.
That's correct.
And then what happens, and then you added another $1.3 million to that, or is the 1.3 part of the 9.25?
No, it's additional. This okay. is money, since
so there's
we
an additional 1.3. Correct. So the question I have now is, from a budgetary point of view, you budget not for cash flow, you budget for what you think might happen. If you're saying at this point that the District of Columbia is going to have to cover this, What you're saying is you do not believe that the garage will be sold and a new site will be chosen, and therefore those funds will be available. Is that the statement you're making from a budgetary point of view? From a cash flow point of view, yeah, you don't have the money yet, but you don't have any of the revenues that are in here yet. Well, I guess you do have some. You have some in the reserve from the fare increase. But other than that, you don't have any of the other revenues. So from a budgetary point of view, you say, I have to assume that something will happen in the future. What I think I hear you saying is you're assuming that the garage will not be sold, the new site will not be determined, and therefore none of that money will be available. Is that right?
Well, I think it's a couple. That's part of it, yes. We did move out of this garage in March, and we began incurring expenses as a result of the dead hand. And those dollars are being charged to the District of Columbia, or is it the 1.3?
Well, Chuck, if you clarify, but I think what we're doing is we're spending the 1.4 million now,
right,
which would run out in the next month or two. And if there is not a new location for the bus site for us to begin the final design and construction, then we would look to the district based on this resolution to make those payments until that site was available.
So you're saying this resolution overrode the previous resolution and said until the new site is available, you may not even budget for that to happen. Is that right? Well, I'm doing this on behalf of the district.
Yeah.
Either if you don't care, and if the district wants to pay, feel free and just go ahead.
Well, we were going to get that. I mean, this is, again, I think the conversation we had about conservative budgeting versus, you know, more aggressive budgeting. So it sounds like we're in the process of, we're very near addressing the sale issue, so proceeds may be made available to cover the cost. The issue in the resolution was tied to the new site, I guess, in my mind. The action was tied to the identification of a new site for the bus garage. And the board's decision to essentially withhold the ability to draw down on funds from the sale until there was an identification of a new site.
Yeah, and if the district feels happy with that, and you're prepared to pay the deadhead as soon as we get past the 1.3 million, I won't make any more noise.
I just clarify, the expense will be there for the deadhead mileage.
Yeah, no, I understand.
It's the source of the funding.
It's the source of
pay
the funds.
For it.
Exactly.
So, is the district prepared to do that? Because that's what the final resolution says.
But that's where we were, and I think that.
Okay.
So we're agreed.
I will stop asking questions.
Just from a
about this
simplistic view, the question is, which money are we going to spend first, assuming we actually clear everything to sell the Southeastern bus garage? Are we going to go into the 9.25 million reserve first, or are we going to spend the district's money? And the only reason that you have to make that decision is because the original staff projection for what it would take to replace the Southeastern bus garage is very close, and it assumed around $1 million to construct and another 9.25 for the additional operating costs on the interim. Starting from the end of March, which is when staff then thought a new Southeastern bus garage site would be available, and we would be moving out of the old Southeastern bus garage. If we don't have the site, then it's going to take more money to pay for the deadhead costs in the interim. And really, it's just a matter of whether we spend money from the reserve once the site is sold, and we all hope that will be soon, or rather the district's money, because we don't have a replacement site. So staff would say, do not believe that 9.25 will be enough to take up, you know, pay for the extra operating costs until we have a new replacement site available. We've issued the RFP. Really just a estimation of cost, and it's up for the board to decide which money would be used.
Well, what I want to put to bed, I guess, and Mr. Monome is going to kind of give the answer to that, is I think you correctly identified what is the order. Now, we all agree that the 1.3 comes first. And the question is, does the district then start paying, or do we draw from a reserve which at this point has no money in it? And What I thought I heard you say is the district is prepared to pay, which is fine, and then we just keep going.
No, that's not exactly what I said. My understanding is that based upon the timing of the transactions that I believe are going to occur, the reserve would be in place. In my mind, that would go. That's what would go first. I think that's. I guess the issue is that we don't have a reserve today.
That's still not quite it, though, because if right now the order of priority under the resolution, the most recent resolution, would have the district's money utilized until both have the money from the sale and we have a replacement fund. If the board chooses to say, once we have the reserve from the sale, that money will be used first, then we could propose language to provide that or effectuate that desire. It's just not the way the last resolution is framed.
So your point is, I guess in my mind, I guess I would propose that we decouple the new site. If we could establish essentially a reserve based upon the sale to fund those additional costs, that's obviously in our
budget. That wasn't my point. My point was the difference between budgeting and cash flow. You would budget to do it the way that you expect it to happen,
right?
Whether or not the money's actually there, because that's what you do in all budgeting. But this is budgeted under the assumption then in this, and that's the critical assumption, is in fact the money won't be there, and the conditions established by the board, which I think are conditions, and we can't at this point change it without going back into that whole issue. Those conditions hold, and it is the judgment of the people proposing this budget that they will not hold during the entire fiscal year, and therefore they don't want to put the money, say that the money will come from the reserve.
Well, obviously, if I have the support of the other board members, I prefer the previous to the latter. I would rather have it budgeted for some other funding source than have to come up with money that I don't have today. But
I guess what I would suggest is, do we have at least a tacit agreement from those of us who are here that should all the conditions be met, then the reserve would start to pay?
Yes.
So the interpretation of the staff at this point is, until such time as that occurs and assumes the $1.3 million goes away without changing any other documents, the district would be on the hook for the funds. And that works for me, because then we don't have to go back and change anything.
Okay, and then we're back to the amendment that I suggested, is that we decouple the replacement facility site acquired, because to me that is the issue. We're going to be able to sell the facility within the calendar year. The issue is the identification of the site, which is still a stickier issue, and then we can address the payment of the garage at a later date. I think, again, decoupling of those two elements is how we address the short-term issue. That's why I said that first.
But in my mind, that then the budget is okay the way it is, and if we want to attack this as a separate issue, we can do that.
Well, if and when. I mean, I don't think I want to approve a budget without addressing the issue. All right, so maybe the proposal is then we have in staff come back with a rewrite based upon, I guess, at least my proposal, that we essentially decouple or strike the phrase "and the replacement Metro bus garage site is acquired."
I'm not sure that that's an order at this particular point. All we're asking is, how did they put this together? Not, do we want to override a previous motion by the board? If so, then somebody here who was on the winning side of that motion, and I don't know who was at this point, we'd have to look that up, would have to bring that up for reconsideration, or else we can't reconsider that motion. Right? I'm sorry?
I don't know that rule would apply.
Because it is a totally subsequent action?
Forever in history.
You can't go back.
Okay.
Really covers the meeting.
Okay. I would suggest that this be something we do out of the context of the budget, not in the context of the budget. Because, in fact, there's not an unreasonable agreement as to how it would handle. And then if we want to do that, which is going to take more than a few minutes, we do that at another time. Okay, I'm sorry, I got us diverted there. Go on with...
Continue?
We're on the subsidy page, reduced subsidy by jurisdiction.
Right, page 21 is the subsidy reduction total, and then by jurisdiction. And unless there are any questions on that, we can move to the capital budget.
I have a question, and I guess I raised the point. I think Mr. Cato was very clear in trying to keep us within the cap on the subsidy. When I look at our numbers, while we are within the cap for Fairfax, we, by absorbing, and I think we absorbed from the prior sheet, the regional service lines. And
page 33.
Page 33 is the description of them. But it reflects that the increase there really increases our subsidy had we not made those adjustments. And I think it goes back to earlier discussions about how do we move from these pilots to the extensions. And extensions are a part of the system. And there's been a discussion early about how do we make adjustments to our budgets. And I think one of the things that we would like to make consistent is that if we're approving a budget, and let's assume we're approving this year's budget, and we are all accepting the extensions as they go, that the adjustments or the audits that we are later impacted by in future budgets really should not adversely, in fact, affect the jurisdiction. Because I think here we're swallowing both ends of this, and I think, well, while we are not talking about what the criteria is that moved us to this, I think it is an important part to recognize the impact that it has on us. And I think it is the Fairfax equally are substantially more than the others in accepting that. I know that Maryland, both D.C., are looking forward to those, and you started them out as pilots, but that does have an impact.
Actually, primarily D.C., but I just want to clarify that as I read these tables, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the number that you see there is a reduction for Fairfax County of $300,000 is after that occurs. So it's not the sum of the two. It's after all of those have been incorporated, you still get a reduction of $300,000. You're saying you wish you had an even larger reduction.
That is exactly right.
I think we just got part of that when we just said we won't do the carryover of $1 million. You just got another chunk of that, and as was pointed out by Mr. Woodruff, there's a $12 million roughly subsidy amount underrun at this point, so you will get some relief here.
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's some moves being made to save money in this budget to do that, some of which may or may not be sustainable. We're not sure about all that, and that's part of what's too. And then there is the question that raised before, which is, okay, this versus other ways we'd be spending. I mean, we might not want a subsidy in any particular jurisdiction, subsidy reduction more, but might have issues about our own services that are sufficiently supplied right now. And have those things been weighed against each other? I think the question.
I do believe that what the general manager did was consistent with the instructions from this committee.
I wasn't suggesting that. I was suggesting.
Right. All right. But I mean, what he's giving back to us is what we told him to do.
And he did. He did. And we're saying, what part of a within that gap? Where did we fall?
I think the other thing that we all raised, and you have a very good point there, is that as we do any one of these reimbursable projects that are being done as demonstrations, we said that we wanted to have criteria given to us at that time as to when and how long they were going to run and on what basis they would be made regular parts of the budget so that we don't get ourselves in this box again. So let's all watch for that as new ones come along.
And the point being that pilots or projects are not given to be regional projects because we've started them yet. And I think we do need to start at some point making that criteria quite explicit so that we actually measure what we're doing.
Give us that direction.
Anything else?
Okay, to move to the capital budget, and I would just point out a couple of highlights here. On page 23, we begin the capital budget, and this is a bit of history. The Metro Matters program projected expenditures of $2.7 billion between '05 and fiscal '10, which we're on target to accomplish. There is what is commonly called the tail or the closeout expenditures of those projects, $400 million, for a total investment of $3.1 billion. On the next page, on 24, this reflects incorporating the proposed reprioritization of funds to meet the urgent unfunded capital needs. And these are all numbers that the board and projects the board has seen before. But essentially what the recommendation is that we would reprioritize the Metro Matters, and in 9 and 10 on this chart, you see an expenditure of $157 million over those 2 years of the funded Metro Matters. And the proposal on the next slide was that we would reprogram $109 million of the existing funding, which left $48 million as, quote, unfunded. And as we've talked before, given that the capital program tends to lag a little bit between the cash expenditures, that we're optimistic we could manage our way through this, meaning we wouldn't have to borrow that money, that projects would just, under normal construction timelines, would be delayed such that we could accommodate this expenditure. That's the major change to the Metro Matters program. And on page 28, I would point out that with this change, the jurisdictional contributions remain exactly as budgeted in the Metro Matters funding agreement of several years ago. I'd be glad to go into more detail on this, but that is the major shift in the capital budget.
So is the expenditures page, the one that precedes revenues page, is that what you're going to ask us to approve?
Yes, and 500 and page 26. The 09 expenditures would be $527.5 million.
I'm going against your old one, which says 534. But that's what you're saying, that we would end up spending?
Yes, sir.
And that's what we would have to approve?
Correct.
Remember that for later. Keep going.
I have a question.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Where in this do we see the bottom line for the capital budget?
Page 36. The column in the middle of the page titled Annual Work Plan, that is the 09 budget for $527 million. And then 010 is for planning purposes, and then there's the out years, the tails.
That's the same. Okay, so you're now calling the capital budget Metro Matters.
With the exception of certain reimbursable projects, that's really all there is.
Well, okay, that's because my recollection of it started anyway. We had a capital budget that was composed of an IRP and SEP and...
SEP and the SAP have really just, they still exist on the books, but there really aren't any viable projects in them right
they're
now.
They're not funded.
I mean, there's a few small projects out there, Glenmont Parking Garage, Dulles, assuming it...
And there's no old IRP stuff?
That's all... It's all included under the line... it gets referred to as TIFIA in various places in the Metro Matters line items. TIFIA is an acronym for all the projects that were underway before Metro Matters got started.
Right. So how come that's not separate? That's what I'm saying.
You mean seeing a separate listing of all the particular...
Why is it including that as... I mean, so that's part of the capital budget, right?
Yes, and it's part of Metro Matters also.
Well, when did it become part of Metro Matters?
It always was.
Well, before there was a Metro Matters, it wasn't.
Right. All the capital improvement projects that were in place before Metro Matters got bundled up under the TIFIA loan guarantee. The TIFIA loan guarantee allowed us to obligate contracts even though there was no funding available.
Saying everything
at the time.
Got folded in.
Yes. Everything got rolled into Metro Matters. It became the all encompassing.
So we can just say the Metro Capital budget.
Yes.
Not even say Metro Matters.
Yes, that's good. Then we lose it.
That's where we're trying to go.
Once we get past 10, it all goes away. We can do something different. I finally figured out where I saw there was a $7 million difference between what you sent out to us and what we've got, and that appears to be in the urgent priorities. You're saying you can do $7 million less than you previously did?
Right. What went out in the mail out had a slightly different expenditure rate in 09 versus 010.
Right.
That's the only change?
Yes, sir.
That appears to be the only change.
That is the only change.
It shifted about $6.9 million shifted from 9 to 10 based on cash projections.
This is based on what you're experiencing at the present time?
Yes.
Okay. Shall we continue?
Resolution. Page 40 in your handout is the resolution to approve the budget. The only modification we would make is 1, 2, 3.
Just before you get the resolution, is there anything else that anybody wants to go through? They were last on about page 26. Is there anything in the rest of this presentation anybody wants to see?
What were the $20 million in reimbursable? Is that capital projects or reimbursable?
They're identified on appendix attachment D behind the resolution. Things like the DC circulator, the George bus route, Falls Church. It's page 54 in the package today.
To the resolution itself.
I have just want to go back very briefly to page 33 again. I still have a remaining concern about what I see. I mean, we gave discussion about having criteria for deciding when reimbursable projects are adopted into the regional operating budget. And what my concern is with this, without criteria existing today, we have existing projects that started as pilot projects that were reimbursable projects that are now in the regional operating budget that are performing very well, not really set out enhancements for. And what my concern is here we're moving additional reimbursable projects that are pilots into a regional operating budget before we've given full evaluation to the optimal funding necessary to have existing projects in the regional operating budget operate properly. And I'd just like to get a reaction from staff. The example that I know of well is the Rex bus system in Fairfax, where, again, this morning I was passed three times because the buses coming by are full by the time they get halfway up the Route 1 corridor. So it's great they're running every 15 minutes, but they're not servicing anything north of Hyble Valley in Fairfax County in the morning because they're full. So my concern here is moving these projects forward into regional operating when the ones we have are not properly functioning. So I'd like to get reaction from staff on how those two work together.
Just a little bit of confusion that happens is we used to have three categories of bus service. There was the regional bus service, basically lines that cross jurisdictional boundaries. And then there was non-regional bus service, which was usually contained wholly within one jurisdiction. And then there was a third category called reimbursable. And that came into existence because of an issue with a union and we got a break on certain wage rates. That provision expired. And basically what it means is there's no difference anymore between reimbursable bus service and non-regional bus service. So those reimbursable routes that used to be tracked separately in the budget that truly are non-regional in nature have just been rolled into the non-regional budget. These four pieces of service were being treated as reimbursable or non-regional, but met the board criteria to be funded regionally, and that's why these four kind of stood out. Everything else that was reimbursable continues to exist, and it continues to exist now as a non-regional route, and it's funded at the level that the jurisdictions want us to fund it at.
So what you're telling me is moving these four into the regional operating budget will not impact at all existing ones that are in there and our ability to expand those?
That's correct. The jurisdictions can choose to fund non-regional service at whatever level the jurisdictions choose. That's the way those routes were established.
What?
Regional service.
Yes.
Right.
That's regional. Regional becomes a joint board decision.
Yeah, I would note in this particular one, I tend to agree with staff, and note that this costs Maryland money too. The only jurisdiction that comes out ahead financially is the district, because this is the way we've always operated, and it does clean the books. The principle, I think, is one of, after something has been operating, and if it is operating successfully, we do make it part of the basic budget. And the net effect on the state of Maryland is a few hundred thousand dollars that it pays more. The big savings comes to the district in a couple million. But the principle, I think, ought to hold.
The principle is fine. My problem is we don't have criteria for determining success. And here we're moving more things into the success category when we have successes right now that are beyond capacity. And so that's where my issue is with it. I understand what you're saying.
I think what we said earlier when we discussed this was every time we do one of these from here on in, we've got to decide what the criteria for success are. Otherwise, we shouldn't do them. So the next time one of these projects comes in front of us, we've got to say, what's the time frame and what's the measure? And if it isn't there, we don't do it.
I guess the question is of timing. Do we take action on these now before we have that information, or do we delay action on that if we have that information in front of you?
Well, Mr. Zimmerman was first, Mr. Bonamy.
No.
Mr. Solomon.
I think part of the problem here is that we had something that we put off any decision on, and we never have actually discussed it as a board. Because these were brought forward previously as things that there wasn't a consensus on doing. Specifically, for instance, in the case of the red line so-called turnbacks, that Maryland has had an issue in doing that for a long time. They'd like to run every train all the way to the end of the line. Of course, we might like to run every train to the end of the orange line, too. It's the same thing. But the question was whether you could justify that expenditure based on the ridership. Now, because there wasn't the agreement to do that, Maryland finally said, well, we want to pay to do it ourselves. And so we said, well, okay, if you want to put up your own money, then I guess. And that has turned into kind of a presumption that it's going to the budget and the cost is going to be shifted onto us. And we never really had the discussion. I've raised this at different points during the budget cycle this past year, but it was always something off there. And here it still is. And I don't think that that's ever been weighed against the other kinds of things that, I got a lot of crowding in the orange line, too. If there's enough ridership to justify running the same level of service in Rockville as you do in Bethesda, well, okay, I guess I'd like to see that. But I imagine there's a case for Vienna relative to Ballston, too. And I've got a bus service that is carrying, that we've instituted and we're paying for ourselves right now, that is carrying a lot of Maryland people from the Crystal City stations to their jobs at EPA. But I'm paying for that whole thing. So we never actually weighed those and said, is there something where, there's some more regional expense that ought to be picked up here? And I don't feel like we've had that discussion, but here we have things that are going to cost, the Virginia side, I think a couple of million dollars altogether. And yet we're saying we don't have money to get more buses on Route 1, where three buses go by full before our board member can get here. So maybe we should be thinking about some of that.
I remember all of these discussions, and at the time we had these discussions as a board, the two Maryland members are no longer on this board, and the D.C. member who brought up the yellow line going to Fort Totten is not here today. But there was some horse trading at this time of year, during that particular year. And if the district wanted the yellow line to go to Fort Totten, then Maryland wanted that turn back. So they got together, and that's what the outcome is with what you have here today. That was just horse trading in the budget. You wouldn't vote for it. Now you have we have to come up with some criteria to address your concern. But in the past, when the issue came up, either you did the deal or you didn't get the deal done. I mean, that was the reality of it at the time. And I mean,
and Virginia went along because it wasn't going to cost us anything.
Right. And now it is.
Now it does.
But anyway, now it's being when I come back next year for the 9S, well, that's different.
But we have to consider the whole picture every time we do these in the future. Otherwise, you know, we get this thing discussion ready.
Well, I guess the question is that it is a budget discussion today when it should be an operation or planning discussion. And that should be the criteria in which it should be made in terms of what we are trying to do here. So, I agree with you with what the history is, but that now we're at this point and it is everybody's trading that has to be at the table tonight, today, or next week, or 2 weeks from now. And I think it's even greater now. The question is, are we providing a regional incentive for why we are doing this? And if we can't justify the regional incentive, the answer to the pilot should be, guess what? It's not a successful pilot. And many of us accept the fact that in order to have the effect of the service that we want, we provide that as a direct jurisdictional service. So I think that is what is here at the point. And I think we're looking at budgets as we've asked for, describing the efficiency of what this budget does for us. And here we have no efficiency that we can measure because we have not come back.
Mr. Roderman. Well, I was going to follow up on Mr. McKay's point about, you know, the process by which projects are going to move into non-regional to regional funded, and I guess a question back: have we ever done any kind of analysis of the ones that have been pushed in and their performance, and even consider the notion of pushing them back the other way? And that sounds almost like heresy. And some transit authorities even talk about that, but that's where we're going.
Well, might I respond for Mr. McKay? I don't think it's necessarily that. I think it's a question of, can you maintain a project that has moved into a regional service that indeed was a good and successful one, and you increase the service relatively versus equally looking at services that we're bringing in and measuring their efficiency for bringing them in. I'm not looking at only one side of it. I'm really saying that if we're going to, I want to think of us as the transit agency doing regional transportation together and sharing the benefits and costs. And I think you need to have a criteria in which you can do that. And then hopefully the issue of who pays and how becomes less of an issue. That's the question.
Mr. Zimmerman.
This last game, asking about the yellow line, I asked for analysis of the feasibility of if we're going to do it, doing it on a full-time basis, off our thing, which seems to confuse our own nation. And I don't think I ever saw anything back on it. Maybe I missed it. I don't really expect you to have it on the spot here, okay. But I would like, before I have to vote on it, that made a difference in whether I thought it was valuable or not.
Okay.
What is the pleasure of the committee relative to this currently being in the budget and moving something to the board?
Chair, I think Mr. Hughes has an answer to the question.
Okay.
How much detail you want
from this? I want detail right now. Time for it.
I thought we did present some information a couple months back about the increase in ridership on the yellow line in the middle of the day, 25 to 26%.
Talking about the technical ability to do it, huh? Can you run the extension as a regular operation as opposed to?
No, we cannot.
Oh, rail car issue or is it something else?
It is during the peak period the cars can only go from the extension could not be at Fort Cotton. We don't have the capability to turn trains around
operationally, you can't do it.
We have to do it at 4:05 during the peak period. We can't do it at the off peak because we're open ahead wide during the peak period.
Pleasure of the committee. We have a budget proposal in front of us, which matches what we did instruct.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we did instruct, but again, some of us provided caveats all the way on the item we're talking about. I don't personally have any problem with the budget moving forward, the understanding that this thing, I'm not ready to agree to. Obviously, we've got to act on the 26th, but I'm not necessarily going to support that.
The concern I have is if you do not do this, you have to have an alternative criterion for the general manager as to how to determine what everybody's subsidies are, and that may result in a different budget structure and a different set of changes that he has to make. I don't think he'll be able to do that on the spot.
Well, I think you've got a $1.8 million problem inside a billion-dollar plus budget. Probably going to have to figure out something. There are multiple options, one of which is to not do this. Not that hard, actually, to figure out. There might be other possibilities, too, but...
But it's going to change everybody's subsidy if you do that.
And we know the amounts. The table there shows you what the change is.
The table shows you what the changes are, right. But if you then want to stay within the limitations of what occurred in what we were given in March, right, then it becomes much more difficult. Because the district's number will drive everybody's number and additional cuts.
I also saw the staff throw $1 million on the table.
Yep.
I guess we can figure out how to do some.
Do we, well, what I'm concerned about is we get to the board and we don't approve a real budget. We approve a budget with a set of instructions to change it. And that could be scary. Because we wouldn't know what we were approving. I can see how we might not be able to approve a budget because people are going to want to know that their subsidies have not been violated, you know, what the grand total is. Now, what we can do is we can go back to the general manager and say, and furthermore, cut the budget in places undetermined in order to get to the following place, but you don't know what it is that the general manager will do. It would be a little bit better if he could tell us what he was going to do.
We could ask him to look.
I mean, yeah, we can ask him at this point to do an alternative budget and see what would happen if these were not approved this way and we still had the constraint of the March totals. But that, then we're going to be discussing that in a board meeting.
We can do an alternative budget from a high level. I would ask that you not ask us to go through department by department detail. And if you make this decision of $1.5 million, then you give me the option of determining where we make the cuts, as long as it does not, for SHIP funds, impact the overall service levels that we propose to operate. That would be my understanding of what you would direct me to do.
I guess what I would be looking for is we'd have to say that the grand total, including these services, would have to not exceed the numbers that you saw in March, that we saw in March. And what would you then have to do to get there?
We have to make reductions in different categories, but I would hope that you're not asking me to get down to
the dollar
weird.
Not to details. And on the same level as you did when you had hit, and this one you had, Here are the major changes, and this is what we have to do.
One request I think we're going to need to make in the future is if we will leave these two pieces of rail service for all time funded by a particular jurisdiction, we've now turned Metro Rail into a regional and non-regional system. And the board has board-approved regional and non-regional rates during the regional mobility panel. KPMG, an accounting company, was hired at that point to determine how to differentiate the cost of regional service from non-regional, and we're probably going to need to have something like that on the railroad now.
Maybe that's an assumption for going forward infinitely, but that does not need to be. if we decide that we're going to look at these as determining whether or not they should be, and maybe we qualify. I think what we want to feel is that we understand the benefit of moving these into regional services so that we all can play a role in that decision versus simply turning the pilot into a regional service. It might mean that it doesn't go in this budget, but it might have a chance to go.
I think Mr. Harkham has raised a good point, but has gone maybe a step too far, and that is, we have tried very hard not to have regional and non-regional rail service. Mm-hmm. We created that when we approved these on the previous deal. And, you know, we probably ought to be trying not to do that, but that doesn't say that we will forever have decided that there will be regional and non-regional bus or rail service. So we don't have to take that next step. We do need to deal with how we're going to, over the long term, both short term and long term, deal with these two particular changes. Okay. Can we move on to the resolution, assuming that we have some ideas to what the resolution will relate to?
Have we given clarity on what we're going to see come back?
Well, I think we asked for, what I suggested was, let me just make sure everybody's okay with this. An alternative which, in fact, holds to the March 28th subsidy distributions on the same basis as we talked about before, but includes these services as the subsidies for, in this case, it would be Maryland and D.C. In other words,
you know, on the same basis that we've been operating.
It can't exceed the bottom line that was in there, because otherwise all you're doing is adding $2 million to D.C. subsidy and all the rest of us save. I know what that number looks like. I'm presuming that D.C. does not want to see a $2 million increase in its subsidy, which means they've got to go back to the March 28th date, which did include these, you know, in, and then do the adjustments and say, what would it have to look like if you went to those same savings?
Okay, so that's the direction.
D.C. got its $2 million, right.
Let me make sure we have it right. Because we don't want to bring this back when we're not right and we don't have a budget for next year.
Yeah, really be giving us two alternatives.
We will reduce the subsidy proposal just as an option for Virginia and the other jurisdictions based upon this breakdown. The District of Columbia's overall subsidy would not increase, which means we have to make a reduction throughout the overall budget to make up for that difference.
No, because that would force you to cut $2 million, and I'm not sure you have to cut $2 million. The constraint is using the formula and taking this out of the formula, which means that this now becomes reimbursable again. The bottom lines for everybody still go no higher than they were in that March table, which is page whatever it is in here. Page 34. Okay, so those bottom lines still hold, but part of the totals are there that are in there are these four services as reimbursables as opposed to as regional services. So the total stays the same, but it all shifts around. If it shifts enough that somebody can't make it, then you have to make a cut, but it may not be this $2 million, maybe less. In fact, should be less.
One question. Are we discussing only the two rail pieces, or are we discussing all four of these?
Okay, good question. Committee, are we discussing the bus services or just the two rail services? All four?
Okay. I mean, two. Yeah, the question is whether we're turning reimbursables into regional service. That's what we mean.
And it's all four.
You know, one option is to go forward with the budget and not do this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another option is to do something else. And I'm willing to hold open the possibility of a something else. But I'll take some work and some discussion.
Okay, so sounds to me like we want to see the other extreme, which is all four as reimbursables, so we can see what the two extremes are. And hopefully that will result in not having to cut the budget by $2 million, which is what you would have to do if you just took this and put it in.
Yeah.
We should have a smaller cut. Okay, shall we move on to the resolution? I have a couple of things I want to just discuss in a resolution to make sure we're clean on a resolution. Because otherwise we're going to get it, and then we'll have this discussion in the meeting.
And we'll need to make one change to the resolution. On page 42, of your packages, 1, 2, 3, the fourth resolved from the bottom. We will strike that because the committee did not take any action on the request to carry over $1 million. So that resolve just goes away.
Right. I have a couple comments. One is the one that I raised for you earlier. If we're going to attach, and I think we should, attach for each one of these elements what it is, I think we need to do the same thing for the Metro Matters capital portion of the budget.
That's fine.
And that's that table that we referred to earlier.
We can do that.
So that we know what it is we're approving and it's broken out. On the resolution that starts, or the resolve that starts, safety and security.
Mm-hmm.
Is the intent there receipt of federal funding for those projects, or is it federal and local, or is it?
I think the intent is anybody.
Well, the original was that the federal government would be making a contribution, right?
Right.
And would there be local share?
No.
No.
So then let's put the word federal in there.
Okay.
The immediately following resolution, I wasn't quite sure what we were saying there and whether we really needed that. This is the one where the general manager has the authority to complete a lower priority if there's a higher priority.
I'm not quite sure why that's in there.
It looks like an authority you probably already have. Yeah. So it's not clear to me why that's there.
Could I? I'd be happy to strike it, Ms. O'Keefe. I'm not sure if that came about last Friday. We can just strike it, I think.
Okay. The following one, the same comment. If we're going to approve an FY10 Metro Matters capital budget for planning purposes,
mm-hmm.
we need to have it somewhere.
It would be in the attachment that we just said.
Okay,
we will
so you're
going
to refer to the same attachment
yes.
to show both of them. And in the following one, the debt service that you're talking, we now have multiple sources of debt service. I assume the source you're talking about here is 103-mile construction program debt service?
Yes, and technically Metro Matters defines short-term borrowing as not debt service. There's an actual definition in Metro Matters. Only if we issued bonds would there be debt service in Metro Matters.
But we do have another set of bonds out there, too, for elevator escalator.
Right.
So this would, in my
but
mind...
But they're considered a cost of Metro Matters.
Why don't we just call this 103-mile rail construction debt service so
agreed.
We know which one we're talking about.
That's fine.
Otherwise, we've just limited you to lower debt service than you really need to pay.
Okay.
On the resolve relating to the GASB,
mm-hmm.
are you talking about... You talk about other post-employment benefits.
That's the
anything other than health care?
Not for us, but the technical GASB statement refers to if we offered, which we don't, life insurance for retirees.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it's really just retiree health, but the GASB statement has that technical phrase, other post-employment retirement.
To limit, since this is a decision that was very, very limited in scope, and Mr. Woodruff stated it very, very clearly, and that was that we decided at this time, that the authority decided at this time not to do the post-employment health care. It didn't decide anything else. We just changed it to post-employment health care?
I think by default, it becomes everything else.
I want to limit our decision to what we really decided.
But I think no decision becomes a decision the way the GASB is written. Right. If the board does not choose to pre-fund, then by default everything is not pre-funded.
Yeah, but there's nothing else you're saying. You never put before us anything else that we should pre-fund.
I don't think there is anything else. I'm just trying to satisfy the technical language of the GASB so that when the auditors come in and judge what we've done, they understand it.
The board comfortable with that, or you want to stick with health care? Comfortable with the word other, which is broad? Okay. We'll leave it. Okay, that's all I've got. Anybody else got any other? And you may need another version of this.
Yes.
Depending
on. There'll be two versions now.
Okay. And there was in our books one change that was separate, and that was to the resolve that about.
Yes, there was a need for clarification on.
Special bus fares?
Yes.
Has everybody seen that? You do have in your books.
It's on page 42, the very first resolved at the top of page 42. That's a resolution just clarifying special fares enacted by the District of Columbia and Fairfax and how we'll handle it for those two jurisdictions.
Are we done with this item?
Pass it on with the qualifications as
yes.
Noted in the discussion.
I just want to make sure that we're done with all the discussion. Okay, so Mr. Zimmerman, would you like to craft a motion that's appropriate for passing the
matter? I just did.
Go ahead and say it.
So we all I move that we pass the committee passed the resolution on to the board with the qualifications as noted in the discussion.
Qualifications as noted in the discussion.
Okay.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We move now to the DC One Card Agreement.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I understand this is something the district's doing that the district's paying for.
Mm-hmm. You certainly do, sir.
Looks like a really neat idea.
I was about to say, it's a neat thing.
I don't feel the need for the presentation. I wouldn't, but I'd be prepared to support the
okay. I think that's an excellent suggestion.
So moved.
I think that the District of Columbia is doing a very exciting thing. It costs us nothing. The rest of us probably ought to be looking at it because it does, in fact, provide a single card for multiple purposes, including every mode of transportation. So we have a motion.
Really be a pilot. We'll fly in.
This will not be a regional project ever.
But others may copy.
But others may copy, and we encourage them to do so.
Me
okay, I'm sorry. So we have a motion, and I thought I got a second over
yes,
here.
Yes, he did. Right,
yes. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That one was easy. The next six, in the same spirit.
Well, you got diesel swap.
Oh, I'm sorry, diesel swap. Sorry. Diesel swap.
Can I ask a question on this one?
Go.
We've done these before. Is there anything substantially different to this than any other kind of?
No,
the
sir.
Only thing I have a question on is that this, in order to execute it, you would anticipate that the price of oil would need to fall to around $90 a barrel.
That's not going to happen.
I mean, yeah. So as far as I can see, Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's any harm in doing this.
No.
And I don't have any problem with it. I just don't have any expectation we're ever going to see that again.
I think you're right. I think they've set a very high bar in terms of what they're trying to do. But in accordance with, I think, one of the things Mr. Monomay was saying, there is on page 76, right, a second bullet in there, which in fact says that we won't do this unless we can make our budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see that in the resolution as well. Other than that, I think it fully meets exactly what Mr. Zimmerman said. So if you can just take that provision, put it in the resolution.
In
so
that
we
case,
don't do
I
this
move approval of the resolution with the qualification or amendment that the chairman just suggested.
Okay. Mr. Monomay, was that what you were going to do also?
Yeah.
Okay.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. That one also passes. Now, we have six that are here, right?
Yes.
You're allowed to come up. I'd propose that we handle these all at once, and let me give a quick history on these. These are the ones that were at the last board meeting. I think there were only five at that time. And a bunch of questions were raised. The general manager withdrew them. One of the issues that I was very concerned about was what flavor money was being used, capital versus operating, and how a lot of this was being presented. I have gone through in detail the six items that are here, and I am extremely impressed with the job that the staff has done, this PEC, and this is almost a perfect model of how these ought to be prepared. In each case, there's a clear description of what's going to be done. In each case, there's a clear description of the finances and how they go. And, you know, other people ought to follow the same model of setting up the finances. And, in fact, each one of them follows the previous one. So you see that if you approve the first one, then the second one has less money available. And if you approve the second one, the third one has less money available. It's split between capital and operating in a way that is consistent with the wording of the document itself. I presume that the staff will, in fact, do what it says it's going to do. And finally, there are two other items that are in here that are very good, and I would note that all of you need to pay attention to them, because one is the impact on operating, and the other is the impact on capital. In several of these, it states very well that if we are going to do this capital project, there's going to be an operating impact, and we need to be prepared a year or two from now to pay that operating impact, and that's going to be part of this budget. With that statement, I'm prepared to move all six of them together.
Second.
And we have a second. Are there any other comments, questions, statements?
I second everything you said and appreciate the fact that good work was done preceding weeks to make everything understood by jurisdictional staff to help board members be prepared, though.
And I hope that other people will use this as a model as they bring stuff to us. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. That brings us up to K, on-call technical consultant services for collective bargaining. Is there interest in having a presentation on this one?
It's within the budget.
This is within the budget, correct?
Yes.
Approval.
Move approval. Is there a second?
Second.
Any other comment? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Information item, how quickly can you do a monthly report where you tell us that you got $12 million to give back to us?
We've got $12 million to give back to you.
Anything else exciting?
Just that ridership growth was pretty dramatic during the month of April. A number of special events contributed to that. And that's it.
I'd like to draw everybody's attention to two items and make a request for the various jurisdictions. We have all of them available here right now. One of the problems that we had this year was We and all of us talk about this as we do our own budgets where we are in our jurisdictions. We tie down what the jurisdictional contribution is way too late. And therefore, it isn't helpful to us to know what it is that we are expected to pay to Metro. I'd like to reverse that if you're all willing to do that. And that is that we give guidance to the general manager right now as to what the subsidy we think we can afford next year will be. And we do this before our July meeting so that in July he can come back to us and say, here's the subsidy that everybody gave me, and if the formula works roughly, this is what would result in terms of an overall budget. Then in September he would come back and give us a pro forma that says, given that, this is what the structure of the budget would have to look like. So what it would do is then allow us to say very quickly, probably by September, do we have to adjust those numbers, or are those numbers what we can ask our jurisdictions to actually appropriate?
Yes.
I just have one concern about July being the date, and I think we're all probably in agreement that September is a good time to start working. My only concern is that I not only want to know what from the standpoint of the impact of the jurisdictional, but I do want to have some sense of the operational budget that is the budget that's coming forward based upon FY09 now and going FY09 for FY10. That is, we're going to ask you for something, and we hope that it will have had some. It's been judged on what our prior budget is or our current conditions are and looking into the future. So I think we're ready to do it earlier, and it helps the jurisdictions. The question is, do we need to start before we look at any numbers at all?
You're asking the question, do we have to tell them how much money they have available before they tell us what they think they need?
Mm-hmm.
I think I know what would happen if somebody told me.
But you do have a budget that you're now being based on.
Right. Any other comments? I'd like to get the process started.
When you say now, do you mean today?
I'm sorry, what?
You said right now.
No, no. Come back in July, or before the July meeting, and we can choose a date, you know, early enough so he can mail it out, that says, this is how much we think we can afford for fiscal 10. Jurisdiction by jurisdiction.
I'm willing to look at the proposal, but I'd like to see it kind of laid out.
And then what would happen was that would then become the basis for a pro forma, which we would get in September. And obviously, we can adjust all of this as we keep going, but it at least gives us something that we can work with in each one of our jurisdictions. And what I would say, okay, so if we're going to look at it, when are we going to do it? Because if we don't decide that we'll do something like this now, it's either at the board meeting or into September.
Share something with your colleagues.
Okay. All right. The other thing that I would like to propose is that as we go through the budget next year, we start with that pro forma, whatever it is that we get in September, which is a basic structure of what the budget would look like, and also a comparison of 09 to 10, what changes. And that as we make changes through the year, all the decisions that the staff makes, all the decisions that we make, each time we get that same presentation over again with a new set of numbers that say, this is what changed, this is where we are now. So we can always go from where were we in the beginning, where were we the last time we looked at it, where are we now, and what changed. Because I know that I got into the situation several times that I said, I don't know what changed here. How come these are different set of numbers? So that we will always be able to track it all the way through, and you'll be able to say, oh, that's what happened. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. So we'll try and get something of a proposal. I'll work with staff quickly and see if we can get something of a proposal about how this process would go. But the idea is to try and give them early warning or alert early notice, and therefore we have early notice so that we can do our appropriations process. That covers the subsequent agendas. Unless anybody has anything else, this meeting up.
Just
yes.
To note,
Mr. Chairman,
as members know, the general manager informed us that we need a special meeting to go into closed session on an item that's minor but really important, I guess. That is not moronic. So I need everybody to convene next door right away.
Do we need a motion?
Or no, that's where we're going to convene next door, and if they take a motion, go upstairs.
Okay. Then this meeting is adjourned. Okay.